James, James, Morrison, Morrison, Weatherby, George Dupree, took great care of his mother, though he was only three. James, James said to his mother, mother, he said he, you must never go down to the end of the town if you don't go down with me. You must never go down to the end of the town if you don't go down with me. James, James, Morrison's mother put on a golden gown. James, James, Morrison's mother drove to the end of the town. James, James, Morrison's mother said to herself, said she, well, I can get down to the end of the town and be back in time for tea. Well, I can get down to the end of the town and be back in time for tea. Well, King John put up a notice, lost, stolen, or strayed. James, James, Morrison's mother seems to have been mislaid. Last seen wandering vaguely, quite of her own accord. She tried to get down to the end of the town, 40 shillings reward. She tried to get down to the end of the town, 40 shillings reward. James, James, Morrison, Morrison, commonly known as Jim, told his other relations not to go blaming him. James, James said to his mother, mother, he said he, you must never go down to the end of the town without consulting me. You must never go down to the end of the town without consulting me. James, James, Morrison's mother hasn't been heard of since. King John said he was sorry, and so did the queen and the prince. King John, somebody told me, said to a man he knew, if people go down to the end of the town, well, what can anyone do? If people go down to the end of the town, well, what can anyone do? J.J. W.G. Dupree took great care of his he was only three. J.J. said to his he said he, you must never go down to the end of the town if you don't go down with me. You must never go down to the end of the town if you don't go down with me. And now it's time for the Northern Storyteller. Hello, I'm Tom Hassler, and I've just sung the song Disobedience from A.A. Milne's book of poems, When We Were Very Young. We'll be reading from the book The Mystic Monkey by Baba Hari Das and Scary Poems for Rotten Kids by Sean O'Hoohen. Two Boasters. Two boys were daydreaming under an oak tree. It was midday, and the weather was hot. One boy was called Pumpkin. His head was big. He had a peach nose and pig lips. His eyes were like ping-pong balls. He was short and fat. The other boy was tall and thin. His neck was very long, like a bird's. His eyes were like an owl's eyes, and his legs were longer than his body. His friends called him Stork, and nobody knew his real name. Pumpkin said, Stork, did you know that my father's very rich? He gave me a house of my very own. The house is so tall that I can see everywhere in the world from the top of it. Stork replied, well, did you know that my father is a great road maker? A heat ruler rolls right through the earth, and when we travel on it, we come out on the other side of the world. Pumpkin thought for a minute and said, is that so? Well, my father is a famous hunter, and one day he killed three lions with one bullet. Stork jumped up excitedly.
Oh, yeah? Well, my father killed a lion without a gun. One day, while walking on the edge of a cliff, he spotted a lion sleeping far below. And he took out his water bottle, and he poured a thin stream over the lion's head. And the lion jumped up and roared. And he caught that stream like a rope, and he started climbing up. And just as he got close, my father stopped pouring the water, and the lion dropped back down on the sharp rocks below, and he died.
Pumpkin turned his head to the side and whispered, it can't be true. Now each boy wanted to prove his superiority. Both were trying to win. Pumpkin said proudly,
my father has such a big house that he needs an airplane to go from one corner to the other. Where's your father's hut?
Stork rolled his owl eyes.
Don't be so smart. My father is a great farmer. He has a huge pole, and the pole is so long that when he lifts it up, it touches the clouds. He collects those clouds with the pole and makes rain fall on his land.
Pumpkin could not think up a story to top this one. He began to frown. Stork was very pleased to see Pumpkin looking so unhappy. And then Pumpkin got very angry and shouted,
"If your father has such a long pole, then where does he keep it?"
"In your father's big house, of course," answered Stork with a cunning smile.
And with that, the boys turned their backs on each other and ran away yelling,
"Lies! All lies!"
The day the mosquitoes ate Angela Jane. Angela Jane was a mean little kid. She bit and she spit and she ran and she hid. She yelled at her mother and she screamed at her dad. Oh, Angela Jane was awfully bad. She'd go in the garden and eat all the weeds. She pulled up the flowers and stomped on their seeds. She chopped all the trees and poured paint on their roots. She bit all the butterflies, put on her boots, and ran through the garden, kicking about, pulling up vegetables. And then she would shout,
"I'm bad, and I'm horrid. I like it that way."
She yelled that quite loudly one certain fall day. When the queen of mosquitoes was trying to sleep, the shouts woke her up, and she started to creep. Up the leaf she'd been sleeping on, looking around to locate the source of that horrible sound. Her eyes fell on Angela, red in the face, sweat pouring off her all over the place. The queen of mosquitoes listened and looked. She sharpened her stickler, made sure it was hooked on quite firmly, then buzzed all the rest of her clan. They met in the trees, and they started to plan. The queen said, "That child is awfully mean. She's full of more blood than I've ever seen. And it's certain her blood is nasty and bad, the kind to make any mosquito quite glad. I suggest we get her and drink her quite dry. That horrible blood will help us to fly and to sting with more power than ever before. Then we'll have the strength to go after more. We'll bite all the people all over the world. Mosquitoes shall rule thanks to that horrid girl." The sky soon was darkened by billions of wings. Mosquitoes were everywhere, sharpening their stings. The sound was so loud it roared through the land. People below did not understand what all of those bugs were planning to do, that they wanted to conquer the world, even you. The bugs swirled and crowded. They flew towards the yard where Angela Jane was working so hard, pulling tails off the cats and pinching their ears. She was laughing so loudly she didn't hear the thunder of bugs descending on her. She just yelled,
"Now, pussycat, let's hear you purr."
The queen of mosquitoes sat on her nose. She stuck in her stickler and turned on the hose. When Angela tried to swat her away, she found that her arms were as heavy as clay. She saw she was covered from toe to her head with bees. Fat mosquitoes, all turning red as they sucked out the blood that they thought made them strong. But as Angela shrank, they found they were wrong. As Angela Jane shriveled up and went dry, all the mosquitoes started to die. For Angela's meanness was simply too thick. The nasty and bad in her blood made them sick. So think, my young friends, when you want to be mean, of what happened to Angela Jane. You've been listening to stories from When We Were Very Young by A.A. Milne, published by E.P. Dutton and Company. The Mystic Monkey by Baba Hari Das, published by Sri Lama. And Scary Poems for Rotten Kids by Sean O'Hoohen, published by Black Moss Press. Northern Storyteller is a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Our program is coordinated by Ron Inouye. Our engineer is Robert Gilfillan. The executive producer is Carla Tonella. And I'm Tom Hassler.
And now it's time for the Northern Storyteller. Hello, I'm Ellen Whitcher. Today I'll be reading from the book A Mountain of Gems, Fairy Tales of the Peoples of the Soviet Land. Old Frost and Young Frost, a Lithuanian fairy tale. Once there lived Old Frost and Young Frost, his son. Young Frost was a terrible braggart. To hear him, you would think there was no one in all the world more clever or strong than he. One day, Young Frost said to himself, "My father has grown old and does his work badly. Now I'm young and strong and can freeze people much better. No one can hide from or get the better of me. I can lick anyone." And Young Frost set off in search of someone to freeze. He flew out onto a road and saw a lord riding in a buggy drawn by a sleek, well-fed horse. The lord himself was big and fat. He had on a fur coat, and his legs were covered with a rug. Young Frost looked the lord over and laughed. "Ha," said he, "you can wrap yourself in furs all you will, but it isn't going to save you. The old man, my father, may not have been able to cope with you, but I can. I'll chill you to the marrow, so hold tight. Neither your fur coat nor the rug will help." And Young Frost flew up to the lord and began plaguing and worrying him. He got under the rug, crept into his sleeve, stole under his collar, and nipped his nose. The lord ordered his coachman to whip the horse and make it go faster. "I'll freeze to death if you don't," he said. But Young Frost went on plaguing him more and more. He nipped his nose till it hurt and chilled his hands and feet and took his breath away. The lord moved this way and that, and he fidgeted on his feet and could not keep from shivering. "Drive faster," called he to the coachman. But after a while he stopped shouting, for he had lost his voice. And he was half dead by the time he was driven up to his house and had to be carried out of the buggy. Young Frost now flew up to Old Frost, his father, and began boasting of his strength and prowess. "Look at me, father," he cried. "Look at me. I am very strong. You'll never be able to keep up with me. Just see what a big, fat lord I froze, and what a warm coat I crept under. You could never do it. You could never freeze anyone so big and strong." Old Frost smiled. "Oh, you little braggart," said he, "do not be in such a hurry to boast of your strength. It's true you froze the lord and crept under his coat, but that's nothing. Look over there. See that peasant in his threadbare coat driving along in that broken old sledge of his?" "Yes, I see him." "Well, he's on his way to the forest for firewood. Just you try and freeze him. If you succeed, then I will believe you when you say that you are strong." "Here's a wonder indeed," Young Frost cried. "Why, I'll freeze him in a moment." And Young Frost rose up into the air and flew after the peasant. He caught him up and fell on him and began plaguing and teasing him. He flew at him now from one side and now from the other. But the peasant rode on and never stopped. Then Young Frost began nipping his feet, but the peasant jumped off his sledge and ran beside the horse. "Just you wait, peasant," thought Young Frost. "I'll freeze you in the forest." The peasant came to the forest. He took out his axe and he began chopping down the spruces and birches. And he went at it so hard that the chips flew to all sides. And Young Frost would give him no peace. He caught him by the hands and feet and crept under his collar. But the harder Young Frost tried to freeze him, the faster the peasant swung his axe. And the more trees he chopped down, in the end, so warm did he get that he even took off his gloves. Young Frost went on plaguing the peasant till he was quite worn out. "Never you mind," said he to himself. "I'll get the better of you yet. I'll chill you to the bone when you're on your way home." He ran to the sledge, and seeing the peasant's gloves, crept into one of them and blew into the other. He sat there in the glove and laughed, saying to himself, "I just like to see how the peasant is going to put on his gloves. I have made them as hard as rock." But the peasant went on chopping the wood and seemed to have no thought for anything else. He chopped till he had enough to fill the sledge. "I suppose I might as well go home now," said he. He picked up his gloves, but so hard and stiff were they that he could not get them on. "Well, what are you going to do now, my good man?" Young Frost said with a laugh. But the peasant, seeing that he could not put on his gloves, took his axe and began striking them with it again and again. The peasant went thump, thump at the gloves with his axe, and Young Frost went, "Oh, oh," inside one of them. And such a trouncing did the peasant give Young Frost that Young Frost took to his heels and was more dead than alive. The peasant drove home, urging on his horse with loud cries, and Young Frost tottered off, groaning, to his father. Old Frost looked at Young Frost and burst out laughing. "Ha, ha, ha! What's wrong, son?" asked he. "You look all worn out." "I am. What was trying to freeze the peasant?" "And why are you groaning so?" "Well, who wouldn't in my place? My sides ache from the hiding he gave me." "Well, now let this be a lesson to you, my son. It's easy enough to worst the lords, loafers that they are, but no one can get the better of a peasant. And don't you forget it." Boroldoy Murgan and His Brave Son, a fairy tale of the Altai. Long, long ago, there lived in the Altai Mountains a man-eating ogre named Almis. Almis had long black whiskers, which he wore thrown over his shoulders like reins, and a beard that reached down to his knees. His eyes were bloodshot. His teeth were large and sharp, and he had sharp claws instead of nails on his fingers, and his whole body was covered with thick hair. Almis was known for his cruelty. He attacked men and women, and he spared neither old people nor little children. He would pounce on his victims and eat them up. So strong and so cunning was Almis that no one dared to go against him. Seeing him, the people ran away and tried to hide. They did not know what else to do. "Oh, Almis is stronger and more cunning than we," said they. "No one can outwit or get the better of him. We must learn to endure and keep silent." And so they endured and kept silent. Now, in one of the villages, there lived a hunter, Boroldoy Murgan by name, who was as strong as he was brave and wise. Some people might go out hunting and return empty-handed, but not so Boroldoy Murgan. He would always come back with a full bag, bringing foxes and sables and ermines and squirrels, and he never came to harm. One day, Almis came down from the mountains to Boroldoy Murgan's village. The people were terrified and began rushing about, not knowing where to hide. And Almis caught one of the children and went back to his lair. While he was near, the villagers dared not speak except in whispers. But when he had gone, they began weeping loudly. "Oh, whose child will the ogre carry off next?" the mothers called out, sobbing. while the children whimpered and the men frowned and were silent. Of them all, Boroldai Mergen alone was not frightened. "It's useless to shed tears or to try to hide," said he. "We must kill Amis. Only then will we live without fear." But this did not convince the others. "Well, how can we kill him?" said they. "We are not birds to soar up to the sky, nor are we fish to hide in the water. Amis is sure to get the better of us all." Boroldai Mergen felt sick at heart. He looked at his son, and he said to himself, "My son did not come into this world in order that Almis might tear into pieces with his sharp teeth. Nor was it for that that all the other children were born. Almis must be killed." But he did not know how this was to be done. To challenge Almis to battle was out of the question. Almis was strong enough to destroy them all, and the villagers stood in fear of him and would refuse to fight him. To outwit Almis, too, seemed impossible, for he was always on his guard and quick to see if anything was amiss. Boroldai Mergen gave himself no peace for thinking about how to rid the people of Almis. He thought and he thought. He thought for a long, long time, and at last he knew what to do. But he told no one what that was. He took his strongest bow and his sharpest arrows, and called his son to his side. "Is there courage in your heart?" he asked him. "Yes, there is," the boy replied. "And is there pity for the people in your heart?" "There is." "Then come with me. Our way will be long and our errand fearful, but go we must. Is there anything you wish to ask me?" But the boy shook his head, and the two of them set off from home and made for the mountains which were known to be the haunt of Almis. They climbed rocky slopes, passed through a dense forest without so much as a footpath to guide them, and reached an open glade. There was a large tree stump there, and some bushes and trees, but not a beast nor a bird was anywhere in sight. Boroldai Mergen stopped, took off his hunting garb, and hung it on the tree stump to make it look like a man, and his son watched in silence. He made up a fire near the stump, and still the boy watched and said nothing. Said Boroldai Mergen, "Sit here by the fire, and no matter what happens, do not run away. I won't. That which you will see will strike terror into you." "It won't." "Well then, sit down and wait." The boy sat down by the fire, and the father took his bow and arrows and hid himself in the bushes. Except for the two of them, there was no one about, and all was quiet and still. A long time passed. Suddenly there came a crackle of branches and a snapping of twigs, and Amis himself stepped out from behind the trees. When he saw the boy sitting by the fire, he gnashed his teeth and rubbed his hands in glee. "I was on my way to the village for meat, and here is the meat waiting for me," he roared. And then he glanced at the tree stump, and taking it for a hunter, said with a laugh, "Well, hunter, watch me eat up your son. You won't dare to defend him." And with these words, he rushed his beard screaming in the wind to where the boy was sitting. He tried to seize him, but the boy ran behind the stump. He ran after him, but the boy kept running round and round the stump, and he could not catch him. Now, Boroldai Mergen took aim, and he shot an arrow, and it hit Amis in the chest. Amis roared out in pain, and so loud were his cries that the trees bent from the sound of them, and the rocks went crashing down the mountain. And Boroldai Mergen did not stop, but kept shooting one arrow after another at the ogre. Almis flew into a rage. He rushed at the tree stump and began trying to bite through it, but could not, and pierced by Boroldai Mergen's arrows, crashed to the ground. Boroldai Mergen went up to him and saw that he was dead. "Come," said Boroldai Mergen to his son, and the two of them set off for their village. They reached it soon enough, and Boroldai Mergen said to the people, "Amis is dead. Now our children will grow up in peace and their mothers will live without fear.
Who killed him?
The people asked. I did.
Why did you take your son with you?
For him to serve as bait for Almi.
Was he not in danger of being torn to bits?
He was. And without another word, Boroldai Mogan turned away and went into his house. And from that day, the people of the Altai Mountains were rid of their enemy, Almi, and lived in peace. You've been listening to stories from the book A Mountain of Gems, Fairy Tales of the Peoples of the Soviet Land, published by Raduga in Moscow. Northern Storyteller is a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska, Fairbanks. Our program is coordinated by Ron Inouye. Our engineer is Robert Gilfillan. The executive producer is Carla Tanella. And I'm Ellen Fritzer.
And now it's time for the Northern Storyteller. Hello, I'm Tom Hassler. Today I'll be reading from the book The Maid of the North by Ethel Johnston Phelps.
Gawain and the Lady Ragnell, an English tale. Long ago in the days of King Arthur, the finest knight in all Britain was the king's nephew, Gawain. He was by reputation the bravest in battle, the wisest, the most courteous, the most compassionate, and the most loyal to his king. One day in late summer, Gawain was with Arthur, the knights of the court at Carlisle in the north. The king returned from the day's hunting, looking so pale and shaken that Gawain followed him at once to his chamber. "What has happened, my lord?" asked Gawain with concern. Arthur sat down heavily.
"I had a very strange encounter in the Inglewood Forest. I hardly know what to make of it."
And he related to Gawain what had occurred.
"Today I hunted a great white stag," said Arthur. "The stag at last escaped me, and I was alone some distance from my men. Suddenly a tall, powerful man appeared before me with sword upraised."
"And you were unarmed?"
"Yes. I had only my bow and a dagger in my belt."
"He threatened to kill me," Arthur went on.
"And he swung his sword as though he meant to cut me down on the spot. Then he laughed horribly, and he said that he would give me one chance to save my life."
"Who was this man?" said Gawain.
"Why should he want to kill you?" "He said his name was Sir Gromer, and he sought revenge for the loss of his northern lands."
"A chieftain from the north," exclaimed Gawain. "But what is this one chance he spoke of?"
"Well, I gave him my word that I would meet him 1 year from today, unarmed, at the same spot, with the answer to a question."
Gawain started to laugh, but stopped at once when he saw Arthur's face.
"A question. It's a riddle, and 1 year to find the answer. That should not be too hard. If I can bring him the true answer to the question, what is it that women most desire above all else, my life will be spared."
Arthur scowled.
"He is sure that I will fail. It must be a foolish riddle that no one can answer."
"My lord, we have 1 year to search the kingdom for answers," said Gawain confidently. "I will help you. Surely one of the answers will be the right one."
"No doubt you are right, Gawain. Someone will know the answer. Arthur looked more cheerful. The man is mad, but a chieftain will keep his word.
Well, for the next 12 months, Arthur and Gawain asked the question, what is it that women most desire above all else, from one corner of the kingdom to the other? Then at last the appointed day drew near. Although they had many answers, Arthur was worried.
With so many answers to choose from, how do we know which is the right one? He asked in despair. Not one of them has the ring of truth.
Well, a few days before he was to meet Sir Gromer, Arthur rode out alone through the golden gorse and purple heather. The track led upward toward a grove of great oaks. Arthur, deep in thought, did not look up until he reached the edge of the oak wood. When he raised his head, he pulled up suddenly in astonishment. Before him was a grotesque woman. She was almost as wide as she was high. Her skin was mottled green, and spikes of weed-like hair covered her head. Her face seemed more animal than human. The woman's eyes met Arthur's fearlessly.
You are Arthur the King, she said in a harsh, croaking voice. In 2 days' time, you must meet Sir Gromer with the answer to a question.
Arthur turned cold with fear. He stammered,
Yes, yes, that is true. Who are you? How did you know of this?
I am the Lady Ragnall. Sir Gromer is my stepbrother. You haven't found the true answer, have you?
Oh, I have many answers, Arthur replied curtly. I do not see how my business concerns you.
He gathered up the reins, eager to be gone.
You do not have the right answer.
Her certainty filled him with a sense of doom. The harsh voice went on.
But I know the answer to Sir Gromer's question.
Arthur turned back in hope and disbelief.
You do? Tell me the true answer to his question, and I will give you a large bag of gold.
I have no use for gold, he said coldly.
Nonsense, my good woman. With gold you can buy anything you want.
He hesitated a moment, for the huge, grotesque face with the cool, steady eyes unnerved him. He went on hurriedly.
What is it that you do want, then? Jewelry? Land? Whatever you want, I will pay you. That is, if you truly have the right answer.
I know the answer. I promise you that. What I demand in return is that the knight Gawain become my husband.
There was a moment of shocked silence. Then Arthur cried,
Impossible! You ask the impossible, woman!
She shrugged and turned to leave.
But wait a minute, wait!
Rage and panic overwhelmed him, but he tried to speak reasonably.
I offer you gold, land, jewels. I cannot give you my nephew. He is his own man. He is not mine to give.
I did not ask you to give me the knight, Gawain, she rebuked him. If Gawain agrees himself to marry me, I will give you the answer. Those are my terms.
Impossible, he sputtered. I could not bring him such a proposal.
If you should change your mind, I will be here tomorrow, he said,
and disappeared into the oak woods. Shaken from the weird encounter, Arthur rode homeward at a slow pace.
Save my own life at Gawain's expense? Never, he thought. Loathsome woman! I could not even speak of it to Gawain.
But the afternoon air was soft and sweet with birdsong, and the fateful meeting with Sir Gromer weighed on him heavily. He was torn by the terrible choice facing him. Gawain rode out from the castle to meet the king, and seeing Arthur's pale, strained face, he exclaimed,
My lord, are you ill? What has happened?
Nothing, nothing at all.
but he could not keep silent long.
The colossal impudence of the woman! A monster, that's what she is! That creature daring to give me terms!
Calm yourself, Uncle, Gawain said patiently.
What woman? Terms for what?
Arthur sighed.
She knows the answer to the question. I didn't intend to tell you.
Why not? Surely that's good news. What is the answer?
She will not tell me until her terms are met, said the king. But I assure you, I refuse to consider her proposal.
Gawain smiled.
You talk in riddles yourself, Uncle. Who is this woman who claims to know the answer? What is her proposal?
Seeing Gawain's smiling, expectant face, Arthur at first could not speak. Then, with his eyes averted, the king told Gawain the whole story, leaving out no detail.
The Lady Ragnall is Sir Romer's stepsister. Yes, I think she would know the right answer. How fortunate that I will be able to save your life.
No, I will not let you sacrifice yourself, Arthur cried.
It is my choice and my decision, Gawain answered. I will return with you tomorrow and agree to the marriage, on condition that the answer she supplies is the right one to save your life.
Early the following day, Gawain rode out with Arthur. But not even meeting the loathsome lady face to face could shake his resolve. Her proposal was accepted. Gawain bowed courteously.
If on the morrow your answer saves the king's life, we will be wed.
On the fateful morning, Gawain watched the king stow a parchment in his saddlebag.
I'll try all these answers first, said Arthur.
They rode together for the first part of the journey. Then Arthur, unarmed as agreed, rode on alone to Inglewood to meet Sir Gromer. The tall, powerful chieftain was waiting, his broadsword glinting in the sun. Arthur read off one answer, then another, and another. Sir Gromer shook his head in satisfaction.
No, you've not the right answer, he said, raising his sword. You failed, and now...
Wait, Arthur cried. I have one more answer. What a woman desires above all else is the power of sovereignty, the right to exercise her own will.
With a loud oath, the man dropped his sword. You did not find that answer by yourself, he shouted. My cursed stepsister Ragnall gave it to you. Bold, interfering hussy, I'll run her through with my sword. I'll lop off her head.
Then turning, he plunged into the forest, a string of horrible curses echoing behind him. Arthur rode back to where Gawain waited with the monstrous Ragnall. They returned to the castle in silence. Only the grotesque Lady Ragnall seemed in good spirits. The news spread quickly throughout the castle. Gawain, the finest knight in land, was to marry this monstrous creature. Some tittered and laughed at the spectacle. Others said the Lady Ragnall must possess very great lands and estates. But mostly, there was stunned silence. Arthur took his nephew aside nervously.
Must you go through with this at once? A postponement, perhaps?
Gawain looked at him steadily.
I gave my promise, my lord. The Lady Ragnall's answer saved your life. Would you have me...
Your loyalty makes me ashamed. Of course you cannot break your word.
And Arthur turned away. The marriage took place in the abbey, and afterward, with Gawain and the Lady Ragnall sitting at the high dais table beside the king and queen, the strange wedding feast began.
She takes the space of two women on the chair, muttered the knight Gareth. Poor Gawain!
I would not marry such a creature for all the land in Christendom, answered his companion.
Well, an uneasy silence settled on the hall, and only the monstrous Lady Ragnall displayed good spirits and good appetite. Throughout the long day and evening, Gawain remained pleasant and courteous. In no way did his manner toward his strange bride show other than kind attention. The wedding feast drew to a close. Gawain and his bride were conducted to their chamber and were at last alone. The Lady Ragnall gazed at her husband thoughtfully.
"You have kept your promise well and faithfully," she observed.
Gawain inclined his head. "I could not do less, my lady."
"You have shown neither revulsion nor pity," she said. And after a pause, she went on. "Come, now we are wedded. I am waiting to be kissed."
Gawain went to her at once and kissed her. When he stepped back, there stood before him a slender young woman with gray eyes and a serene, smiling face. His scalp tingled in shock. "What manner of sorcery is this?" he cried hoarsely. "Do you prefer me in this form?" She smiled and turned slowly in a full circle. But Gawain backed away warily.
Yes, of course, but I don't understand."
For this sudden evidence of sorcery, with its unknown powers, made him confused and uneasy. "My stepbrother Sir Gromer had always hated me," said the Lady Ragnall. "Unfortunately, through his mother, he has a knowledge of sorcery, and so he changed me into a monstrous creature. He said I must live in that shape until I could persuade the greatest knight in Britain to willingly choose me for his bride. He said it would be an impossible condition to meet."
"Why did he hate you so cruelly?"
Her lips curled in amusement.
"He thought me bold and unwomanly because I defied him. I refused his commands, both for my property and my person."
Gawain said with admiration,
"You won the impossible condition," he said, "and now his evil spell is broken."
"Only in part."
Her clear gray eyes held his. "You have a choice, my dear Gawain, which way I will be. Would you have me in this my own shape at night, and my former ugly shape by day? Or would you have me grotesque at night in our chamber, and my own shape in the castle by day? Think carefully before you choose." Gawain was silent only a moment. He knelt before her and touched her hand.
"It is a choice I cannot make, my dear Ragnall. It concerns you. Whatever you choose to be, fair by day or fair by night, I will willingly abide by it."
Ragnall released a long, deep breath. The radiance in her face overwhelmed him.
"You have answered well, dearest Gawain. For your answer has broken Gromer's evil spell completely. The last condition he set has been met, for he said that if after marriage to the greatest knight in Britain, my husband freely gave me the power of choice, the power to exercise my own free will, the wicked enchantment would be broken forever."
Thus in wonder and in joy began the marriage of Gawain and the Lady Ragnall.
You've been listening to a story, Gawain and Lady Ragnall, from the book The Maid of the North. Written by Ethel Johnston Phelps. Published by Holt, Reinhardt, and Winston. Northern Storyteller is a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska, Fairbanks. Our program is coordinated by Ron Inouye. Our engineer is Robert Gilfillan, and the executive producer, Carla Tonella. I'm Tom Hassler.